Big D Entertainment presents the Dave Holly Hour. Brought to you by Dazzle Shows Presents, The Vaudies, and Dipsy Doodle Productions. He's a variety entertainer, a former broadcaster and columnist, a true lover of arts, entertainment, good food, and fun times, including an occasional Jack Daniels. Okay, so a few Jack Daniels. Here he is, Dave Holly.
Happy New Year and happy weekend eve. Oh, and it's starting off to be a good weekend eve because my good friend Todd Hewitt, who is a regular listener, knows that I like to record with a little Jasper Newton, better known as Jack Daniel. And he gave that to me for Christmas, so thank you, Todd. We unwrapped the gift, and, well, it's going to be gone real soon. All right. Hey, by the way, I just want to say that the 2019 certainly was quite a year for me. A new grandson came into the picture in February, started the podcast in early to mid part of October, but it was late in the year comparatively to when I wanted to start it. But enough of that. We're moving on as to why that took so long. We are now on to episode number 13 as we start 2020. But to 2019, thank you. Appreciate everything you gave us. It's been fun. All right, speaking of fun, one of the things we like to do here on this show each week is give out an honorable mention, and we're trying to build the integrity of an honorable mention so that it's not that, oh, you came in fourth place, huh? No, this is an honorable mention for something that tickled my funny bone. At least that's usually what it is. Sometimes it's something that made me just think, go, throughout the week. Well, this time it goes to my friend Mike Henriksen. Mike has some hands that shake a little bit. And on a Facebook post after the first day of crappy weather that we had recently, Mike wrote, "I know a lot of you worry about me because my hands shake. And I really appreciate that. But it turns out that tremors like mine are actually an asset when it comes to spreading ice melt pellets on sidewalks." So thank you, Mike Henriksen. You are episode number 13's honorable mention. Episode 13, however, will not be unlucky. In fact, it's going to be a best of 2019. 2019 also included 19 conversations. This show is about Sioux Empire arts and entertainment conversations. We'll hear parts of six of those when we come back in a moment.
Ladies, when it's time to give your nails some love, get that extra special treatment from Quality Nails on South Minnesota Avenue in Sioux Falls. Manicures and pedicures that look great and make you feel fantastic. Zaya and Tony provide professional care for your hands and feet, whether you just want the basics or an extra special look with added flair. Oh, and guys, it's okay to treat yourself too. Quality Nails. Call for an appointment. 605-334-1463.
Welcome back. Once again, here's Dave Holly.
Robin Byrne was the first guest on this show. He is the executive director of the Sioux Empire Community Theater, and one of the things that he wanted to talk about was the future of SECT.
Moving forward with this expansion and this, you know, bigger regional footprint, etc., I'm really looking forward to marketing a plan to grow an endowment. I'm looking at that $7 million endowment that they've got down there in Omaha, and I'm thinking, boy, would I like something close to that. And I think realistically, it's achievable to reach for $5 million. If in reaching for $5 million I fall a little short and I only end up with $2.5 million,
Still well done.
I'm not going to be disappointed.
Right.
Right. But the revenue that comes in from endowments like that really do secure our future. And everything we do on ticket sales is, you know, is a bonus on top of that. And the Mamma Mia ticket sales were just sensational.
So along with that then, what do you see beyond, you know, 2 years, 5 years, and so forth? What do you think Sioux Empire Community Theater, you mentioned you're striving for excellence in terms of the production.
Yeah.
What are you looking for as SECT being the premier, so that maybe even people from Omaha and the Twin Cities and so forth, North Dakota,
yeah,
say, you know what, I've heard about Sioux Empire Community Theater. I understand they're putting on some incredible productions.
Yeah.
Let's get down there.
The reality of it is some of the productions we're putting on at the moment are every bit as good as anything you might see at the Guthrie or anywhere else. I mean, I've lost count of the number of people who came along to Steel Magnolias and Mamma Mia and just said, wow, you know, this is the most fun I've ever had at the theater. You know, we do pretty good shows. We need to market that in order to create that vision that you're talking about there. I would like to see us expanding to do more shows per year. In order to do that, I need to expand the staff that work under me, which at the moment is a couple of part-time people and a bunch of volunteers. And I need to be able to convert some of those part-time people into full-time mm-hmm. employees and some of those volunteers into part-time employees so that we are resourced to manage that expansion and do a quality job. I even see us maybe at some point in the future, and don't hold me to this either, but we might want to own our own space again. Right. You know, the Playhouse, which preceded the community theatre, used to own the Orpheum, and they ran into financial difficulties by expanding beyond their capabilities at the time. I'm not going to allow that to happen while I'm executive director. It's very much taking a business approach first, and the theatrical approach second. The fortunate thing for the company at the moment is that I have a foot firmly in both camps. I trained in theatre and was a drama teacher and then a head of a drama department in a college. And then I joined Xerox and became a businessman and ended up running operations for Xerox in the north of England. And then I set up my own company, helping other companies to translate their good intentions into very measurable outcomes. So I'm able to combine both to making sure that the Sioux Empire Community Theatre is financially sound and on a good solid business model, and then that the quality of what we're doing because of that financial underpinning that we have is really maximized to the hilt. Yeah.
Okay. I want to get back to something else you'd mentioned earlier about the fact you're going to have a different space for constructing sets.
Yeah.
And hear about that. And I just want to lead into it with, at my regular job then on Friday, I mentioned we'd been to Mamma Mia on Thursday night and what an incredible show it was. And the gal I was speaking to was talking about she had taken her daughter to see Chicago at the Orpheum after having seen it at a pavilion show, seen the movie and so forth. And she says, all I could think about was, how are they going to do a big production on that small stage? And I said, well, they hit Mamma Mia. She says, yeah, they hit Chicago too.
Yeah.
And did so well. So that takes, in the bit of theater that I had in college,
yeah.
Aside from the acting part, but being in a class, learning, and having to do some practicum in the shop,
yeah.
I was just amazed at seeing how that all comes together. That is something so many people are unfamiliar with when they go watch a show.
Yeah.
They just take it for granted that, oh, yeah, well, okay, now we're in the Seaside. Now we're over here. So that takes a lot.
Yeah.
So where is the new shop? What's it going to be? What all will entail? And how is it going to benefit SECT?
Well, the new shop is almost next door to the old shop.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, it backs on at 90 degrees to the old shop. But it's it's half as big again. And I've got to give a shout out here to the people at Lloyd Properties, because I went to have a meeting with those guys to hit them up for a donation. And I wanted them to sponsor a show. And the conversation went along the lines of, you know, this is something we think we might be happy to do, Robin, next year. But this year, our philanthropy dollars are pretty much allocated. So I just casually suggested that maybe they would like to build our scene shop out for us, because all we have up there is a big empty unit, you know, and it needed a lot doing to the interior. And we'd had plans drawn up free of charge by the Stone Group architects who've supported us in the past. And the build-out was going to cost in the region of about $50,000, which we really didn't have in our budget. And without skipping a beat, Lloyd Property said, yeah, we'll do that for you.
Fantastic.
And they got all of their contractors to come on board with it. People like Shornemans, who provided the lumber and component manufacturing. And I did this the other day in an interview. I can't remember the name of all of their guys. And I'm just so grateful to them, because it involved everything, including sprinkler systems and plumbing and electricity. You know, and the speed at which they are working and providing this for us is phenomenal. So we're moving into that in the next 2 weeks. Which is a big undertaking, but we'll have the space we need to construct the sets, and you know, set design is a real skill. It's what I actually majored in at college, set design and acting, and the things you can do with basic minimal sets, lighting and curtains, sometimes, you know, boggles the mind. And the way technology is going as well, these LED curtains that they now produce that can create illusions that amaze audiences, that might be something on our shopping list that we might want to get somebody to be kind enough to help us buy, you know, at some point in the future.
Bob Wendland is one of the founding members of the Goodnight Theater Collective, which has been an incredible asset to this town over the past couple of years. They are now with sellout shows continually, wrapped up a couple of them this past December. They were phenomenal. They always have a great show. He talks about how it started.
So the abbreviated origin story, I guess, of the Goodnight Theater Collective is that four of us, myself, my friend Martha Stye, who I went to college with and obviously stayed in touch with after college, and then our two other friends, Ruth Sturm and Sydney Place-Sahlstrom, we were in a show together actually at the community theater here in Sioux Falls, and we noticed that there was sort of an opening, I guess, in the community for some theater that was on a level that professional artists would really be able to, you know, sink their teeth into and be compensated appropriately for it. Mm-hmm. We always, from the very beginning, we were very, very aware that something we didn't want Goodnight to be was competitive for any other, like, theater groups that were already in town. I think that Sioux Falls is special in a million ways, but one of the ways that I think it's most special is that we have all of these different people who are active in the arts community, and it's not competitive in the least. You know, everybody has sort of carved out their own little niche. Everybody is able to find the audience that they, you know, need to survive as a business, and they get to continue to create the art that they are, you know, so passionate about. So when we started, we really wanted to have a small group of really talented and trained, professionally trained theater artists who would create musical theater through cabaret style performance. So, you know, it's a very unique type of theater for anyone who has never seen it before. We like to call it two parts concert, because it's all music, and then one part theater, because we try to add a little bit of pizzazz and a little bit of gimmick to some of the songs.
Through costume changes.
Yes, some costume changes. Yeah, there's definitely not a like a storyline. There's no plot to it. It's just an hour and a half of music that falls into a certain theme based on, you know, whatever theme we've decided to do that night. And yeah, so we started with pretty humble beginnings of, you know, like a $50 budget to buy some props and costume pieces and whatnot. And now in season four, we've added original musicals. We will premiere our third original musical this season in March. We've done, Rocky Horror this October will be our third, our third non-original musical. We're continuing to do more cabarets as well. So we've got 8 shows total this season, which is a little crazy to think about. But, you know, we have been so blessed to have, this season we have 30 really, really phenomenally talented performers, all of them like cast perfectly in the role, or some of them roles, some of them are doing 2, 3, even 4 performances this season, and they are just, they're hardworking, they're humble, they connect with their fellow performers in such a like impressive way on stage that it's just electric to watch. So
before we get back to talking about this season, one of the things that you mentioned, and it's been talked about before, is not just the immense talent in this town, and the little niches, as you say, that have been carved out for everybody to have their own slice of the audience, but the support amongst all of those groups as well. There's been a great when I go to a show of yours, I see somebody from a band, or I see somebody from another theater company.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they're not there to spy and say, ooh, what are they doing? It's everybody's having a good time enjoying what we have going on. What do you like, besides your own group, then, when you go out? What are you looking for in entertainment?
Yeah, so we were actually, as a team, just talking about this the other day, about how it gets to be so difficult as theater creators and artists in this town to support everybody else on a very like boots on the ground type of way, because you're so wrapped up in what you're doing and you're working so hard, and you know, when one show is done, you're the very next day you're starting on the next one. And so 2 seasons ago, we started a little initiative with Goodnight called Goodnights with Goodnight, where every single month we choose a different theater company. And we call out to all of our, Facebook followers and our collective members and whatnot, and say, hey, we're going to go and support, like last week it was the How and the Why that the Monstrous Little Theater Company did in the book co-op. And it was a phenomenal performance. I mean, 2 rock solid actresses, Debbie Jones and Sarah Crosby, who just told the story in such a magnetic way. And there were a small contingent of us from Goodnight that came and supported them. And it's just in an effort for us to keep ourselves grounded in a way, and to keep ourselves plugged into the community, because we have, I mean, Debbie, performs with the Goodnight Theater Collective. She'll be in, a cabaret this season. Another one of their, leaders in that team is in Chicago this season. We have people from the community theater that do stuff with us and the community theater. We have people in Improv Falls that do stuff with us. Some Zach Dresch, who's in some bands, and is a comedian in town. So, I mean, we've been very lucky to...
And the flu bug.
Yes, he is the flu bug. We've been so lucky to be able to overlap with so many of these companies. And so it sort of forces us to stay plugged in and stay connected. And it's so cool. It's such a cool thing.
Nancy Halverson is an amazing lady. She also happens to be the executive director of Levitt at the Falls. You're saying, what is Levitt? Well, I'll tell you what I can give you. It's a great place to go watch free concerts in the summer in Sioux Falls, next to Falls Park. It's interesting how it all came about. And Nancy also told us how Levitt itself started.
You know, this is one of my all-time favorite stories to tell, because it touches my heart every time I get to share it again. So thank you for inviting me to do
anytime.
That. So Mortimer Levitt was a very poor boy. He lived on the East Coast. His father actually sold trinkets at Coney Island for a living. And Mortimer would go to work with his father. He would hear the music at Coney Island, want to go see the shows, but he couldn't afford a ticket. And he swore as a child that if he ever made his fortune, he would make music free for everyone. And that's what he's done.
Story.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, it really just planted something in his heart, and he set out to do it, and he made it happen. So then he and his wife, Mimi, started with an amphitheater, actually where they lived in Connecticut. It was a amphitheater that the city wanted to renovate, so they put in the lead gift for it. They were so amazed with the response from the community, they said, we can do more. And so they started building these Levitt pavilions all over the country. So we are the eighth in the network. And they come in, they find a city that is interested. It's very competitive. They meet with the city leaders, and they make an agreement, a three-way agreement, where it's the Levitt Foundation, the city, and then a private nonprofit, which is our Friends of Levitt, which I run. Together, the city donates the land. The Levitt Foundation puts in some of the money to build it, and the nonprofit has to raise the other third. So they build the venue. Once it's built, the city steps back. The city will own it, but they don't put any more operating dollars into it. We will continue to raise funds. The Levitt Foundation nationally will continue to give us some funds, and that's how it goes. But it means that we can make all these great shows free.
It's just amazing. And you hear something like that, you know, from the outside looking in. You might think, oh, yeah, I wonder what the talent's like and so forth.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that. This was top notch.
You know, it was so much fun choosing the bands. And really, there's a lot of kind of misunderstandings about it. A lot of times people think that the artists go from Levitt venue to Levitt venue around the country, but that's not the case at all. The Levitt understands that every community is different and that the musical taste of the community are different. And so we get to choose them all, with the exception of one. There's one Levitt national tour that happens each year, and this past year it was Flor de Toleache. So it was an all-female mariachi that has just won the Grammy for Best Latin Music. So they're not slackers.
I mean, exactly.
These are great.
Yeah, you got a Grammy under the belt. You're doing all
they're
right.
They're pretty okay. They're pretty okay. And they were phenomenal. But what the Levitt National kind of challenges us to do as we curate the season is to really think about our community. What will they respond to? What kinds of music would they like? And who can we put on our stage that looks like our community? So if we have a large demographic that's Spanish-speaking, we're going to try to find Spanish-speaking bands. We're really going to try to deliver so that everybody sees somebody that looks like them and sounds like them when they come to the Levitt at some point in the season, and that they'll feel welcome and feel like it's a place that they can come and be a part of a community.
How far in advance did this take place before we actually got to the point of opening night?
A long time. You know, the stories I've heard, it goes back 10 years. Tom Dempster knew somebody who knew somebody at the Levitt National, brought them to town, and they basically fell in love with our community. Tom Dempster went to the Community Foundation and said, I'm a big thinker, but I need a strategic partner who could help get things done. And of course, that was my dear friend, Jennifer Kirby, who gets things done. And so Jennifer became the board chair, and really together they committed about 10 years of their lives until we opened.
That's fantastic. You know, it was interesting because in terms of my own personal part of it, my wife and I love to go down to Falls Park.
Yep.
And so we would drive past and we'd see things going up throughout its construction period. It's like, yeah, looks like it might be kind of fun and so forth.
Cool.
And then the opportunity came around. You were looking for volunteers to help out throughout the summer. And so we thought, oh, yeah, let's give it a shot. And we go down there and you hold the volunteer training on that stage. And when you open up the back and everybody walks in, sits down on that stage and looks out and you go, wow.
Pretty cool.
This is a great place.
It is a beautiful venue. Beautiful. It's beautiful, you know, just because of the landscape for one thing. But to think about what it used to be, you know, I mean, to remember the brown field that
true.
Space was for so long, everybody sort of just turned their head and walked by it. Now it's the centerpiece, but it also is acoustically beautiful. I mean, when you're a band and you're playing on that stage, it is a great sound.
In fact, what do they tell you after they've been here?
You know, they all tell us that it's phenomenal. I mean, they just can't get over it. And in fact, the folks from the National Levitt all came to our opening weekend, and they kept saying time and time again, the acoustics here are incredible. You can sit in the front, you can sit in the back, and you hear every bit of it. Now, part of that is the landscape, but I also have to give some love to our partners in this. Rob Euling and DMM Systems, they do all of our production work, and they are world class, just world class.
You know, in fact, one of the things that I thought was maybe just a bit of a downfall was the fact that the sun was still up so often that we didn't always get the great lights. Full effect of the lights.
I know.
Because they were great.
They are beautiful. They are beautiful. We knew that going in, but we thought, no, we need to do this. You know, and next year, this year it was 30 concerts.
Shows, and you're expanding
next
to
50. Year it's 50. So okay. We will go further into the fall. So we'll get to see more of the lighting next year.
We like that.
Yep.
All right. So let's talk some of the statistics then.
Sure.
30 shows took, well, 30 mm-hmm. were scheduled. You had to cancel a couple because good old Mother Nature in South Dakota doesn't always abide by our rules.
But we were pretty lucky. I mean, we only lost, I say, 2.5 shows.
Right.
One got started and then the lightning started. So 2.5 shows we lost, which was pretty good.
That is. Yeah. Good batting percentage that way.
Absolutely.
You started off on a bang. And then you bring in another national act and trumpeter Allen, correct? Last name was Allen?
Cole Allen. Yep.
And I'm sitting there going, wow, this is amazing. And then it's like, might be kind of tough to top.
Yeah.
Then we go back another week later. Oh, that's amazing. And the amazings out of our mouths just kept adding up all summer long.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, it was so phenomenal. Glad. And you know, like you said, that the Levitt is good enough to say, hey, we want to see what interests your area and your community. And one of those would be Spooncat.
Absolutely. You know, I would say we are so proud of the fact that out of our 30 concerts last year, 10 were South Dakota artists.
Yeah. And then Brulé.
Brulé. Oh, my gosh. That was incredible.
Didn't get to stay for the show. We had to run down because a friend of my wife's wanted a CD. So I thought, okay, we'll just hop out of the car and go over to the merch tent and buy one.
Good luck.
It's like they're sitting on the other side of Phillips Avenue for this.
It was crazy. There were over 8,000 people. Now, the green was built for 3,000 to sit comfortably. 5,000 squished standing room. And we were at 8,000.
Yeah.
And probably more. But, you know, it gets to the point where they just keep moving and you can't count them. but it was remarkable. And I tell you what Paul and the band did that night to really mesmerize that audience and bring a sense of joy and peace and community, it was awesome. I mean, it was truly awesome. And I wish everybody could have been there, you know. But I have to say, as the venue manager, so to speak, I'm sitting there and people keep coming and they keep coming and I'm going, oh my God, what are we going to do with them all? But they were beautiful. Everybody was so respectful and well-behaved and engaged. It was a great night.
That's a good thing. No doubt about that. What was the first year projection for total in attendance?
You know, honestly, when I was talking to my peers, the other executive directors from the other Levitts around the country, they said, no, don't get your hopes up, right? The first year, it's going to take people a while. You may get 20,000, maybe. You'll have days when you have 200 or 300 people on the lawn. Don't let that worry you. It'll grow. Well, holy mackerel.
It grew.
We were almost at 54,000 people by the time it was all said and done. And that's with having to cancel.
Right.
You know, so extrapolate that out. I mean, who knows how big the number would have been, but I mean, it was remarkable. And we never had a day where we had less than 500, 600 people on the lawn.
And that's amazing because there were some times when that lawn was about 98 degrees, too.
Oh, it was hot some days. It was really hot. Yeah.
But fantastic numbers, obviously. But what maybe surprised you most of all out of the first season, besides the numbers?
You know, I guess surprised isn't the right word. I think pleased, because it was my vision, and to see it come to fruition really meant so much to me. So I wasn't surprised, but I was delighted. Yeah. That's okay. Was the diversity on the lawn. You know, people from all walks of life. We saw, you know, CEOs of major corporations down to people who I know, it was a struggle for them to have a meal that day. Mm-hmm. You know, and in fact, one of our super fans, we call him, is a homeless gentleman who came to every concert.
Wow.
And he just became a part of our family. Yeah. We looked for him, you know, every night, and he looked for us. And it, just the relationships that were built, it was just beautiful.
Well, that's a good word you used right there, too, family, because that's the other great aspect of this is a family venue. These are family events. Yes, there may be some wine, beer, a couple of mixed drinks and so forth, but food trucks are there. You've got things for the kids to play in in the back, and there's always something going on. in addition to the show itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, that couldn't happen without all of the community partners that we have. You know, Sanford stepped up from the beginning and said, we want to be your season sponsor. And they brought out those great blue blocks that you're talking about that the kids were playing with. Of course, then we had different genre sponsors, you know, Avira Health right there beside Sanford. Everybody's playing nicely together. Mm. We love that. You know, we had some of the banks who were there. Everybody's supporting a different piece of it. And then each concert had a sponsor. So there were multi-levels of involvement where people just said, we want to be a part of this. We want to make it happen. It's not about yours or mine. It's about how do we bring this together for everybody.
Jesse Moffitt is a local comedy magician as well as a hypnotist. And that magic bug, it started early.
Back when I was a wee little boy and my grandpa's first cousin lived in Hills, Minnesota, and was a magician. And he came and did a birthday party for my brother's birthday, one of my brothers. And afterwards, we had to go to bed, and he stayed around, talked with mom and dad, and I was thirsty. So I went down hoping he would show more tricks, but did not. I was sent back to bed. Yes. And then many years later, he had a family reunion in Hills because he had cancer, and Moffitt family were pretty much a joking family, and mom and dad told us, make sure you don't criticize him or joke around for his bald head. Since he had cancer, he lost his hair. And afterwards, we went, mom and dad volunteered everyone to go to his house and help clean up the mess that everyone made, and he gave us a tour of the house and eventually showed us some tricks. And the next day I went to the library and checked out a magic book. Back in the day when you went to the library and checked out books.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly. And so there was a book about magic, though, that was available. I mean, because everybody thinks, okay, magic, the secrets and so forth. Do you recall the title?
I don't. I can, it's a common one. I didn't get very far in it. And then of course, soon, not too soon after, probably a few months or whatever, he passed away. And trying not to be too intrusive on his spouse, I sent a letter back when you still wrote letters.
Right.
And asked if she would be willing to either sell some of his magic, because back then we didn't have internet to easily access magic tricks. We had to drive many hours away to the cities, and now you can order it online and you got it at your front door. But so his son already took most of it. She said he left some behind by accident, so I got all that. And it, just after that, I mean, it was starting to make coins vanish. And on basketball trips, football trips, in the bus, I would practice it over and over again. And and then, thank goodness, dad being in the Great Pretenders, met magicians out on the road, and would get their names and numbers, and lots of guys gave help. And Dick Oslin came through town a couple times. I'm sure you remember Dick. He basically is responsible for teaching me how to put together a show.
Really?
Otherwise, who knows what we'd have. But yeah, he spent hours, all for a free dinner, you know, kind of thing at mom and dad's. So it was, that's how it all began.
So coins vanishing and so forth.
Yeah.
But do you recall the actual first trick?
It was probably just a coin vanishing. First trick I actually got was, I want to say it was a cardboard appearing box or disappearing, you know, open up the front, open up the top, looks empty, close them up, say some magic words, and poof, open up the top. There's a bunny rabbit inside or whatever, just a stuffed one. Couldn't fit a real one. It'd be kind of gross.
So at this point, how old were you?
I want to say, you know, this is always a part that I can't quite remember, but I want to say like 12, maybe 13. So later than a lot of guys that I've heard. But it just, never since then, slowly but surely grew.
So, excellent. Yeah. Well, and so what do you consider yourself in terms of the magic shows that you put on at this point in your life? You know, are you a party host type, or are you a stage show magician? What do you like to label yourself as when you're going out and promoting yourself?
I am a comic magician, and I can entertain hundreds or one. Mm-hmm. I don't perform the big illusions, so
right.
It's nice to have a good sized crowd where you're in the hundreds, but not so large that people are like, oh, this was stupid. I can't see anything he's doing. So it's, I'm just a comic magician, and I perform for few people or many people.
Right.
And it's however many people you have there, which determines that. And, we always have a good time. So that's never an issue. So, yeah.
When it comes to the magic realm and so forth, I've obviously seen you perform. We've performed together
right.
on a few occasions and so forth, and I've always enjoyed it. When we were doing some Vaudis shows, you were in one of those. What is it that you like to get up in front of people and do, or an emotion you're looking to get from them?
My first one's always been laughter,
mm-hmm.
and that's just natural family trait that we have. If you ask some family members, they don't think that trait really is there anymore. They're more annoyed. but it's that's what it is. It's to want people to laugh. I think it's some people come off when they answer this question, and I think they sound a little, I don't know, maybe a little fake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more of a selfish thing I have. It's more of a, it's not, sure, there's part of me that wants them to have a great time and forget their troubles and sorrows or whatever they might have. And that's what everyone says. But I think it's more that I crave attention.
You need it too.
Yeah. And I need it too. And people are laughing and I'm laughing with them. And that's the way every show goes, pretty much. I'm having 50 million times as much fun as everyone else,
right.
if not more.
And well, and the thing that happens when a performer is having a good time is that 99.99% of the time, the audience is going to have a good time because they see that in you.
Right.
What's the advantage of being a comic magician versus, a table hopper just doing incredible card tricks and so forth?
When one is failing, the other one can hopefully pick up where the one is failing. So if my trick stinks, maybe I'm funny and that saves the whole routine.
Mm-hmm.
That's nothing I've really thought about now. It's kind of like a surprise fart I just had. Pew.
But, it's good beer, isn't it?
Yeah. It's bubbly. That's what I think it is. I think they support each other.
Right.
And like I said, one's a little weak on something by chance. It doesn't necessarily happen every time. Maybe the next time I perform that trick, it's equally, or the trick is heavier than the comedy, because a lot of my stuff is off the cuff.
Right.
I don't have a lot of set things I say. I probably do now after all these years. I'm trained well enough to kind of keep that stuff in that happens that's funny and try to get it to happen again.
By the way, Jesse is going to be at one of my favorite haunts, the Sky Lounge and Tea. His hypnosis show will be Saturday the 18th. That's right, this January 18th, 9 p.m. at the Sky Lounge. A man that's been performing for many years all throughout the Upper Midwest, John Mogan, remembers the first gig they ever had with Mogan's Heroes.
We played in Chancellor. Gene and Dale Dannon had a Halloween party, and there were probably maybe 30 to 35 people in their garage, and it was just fun. I'm going to keep doing this.
Right.
Well, I'd done quite a bit of playing before that, but...
Yeah, in fact... Now, do I recall correctly, were you part of the Ups and Downs?
I was.
You were?
Yeah.
Yeah. That goes back a ways, too, because I remember seeing them And I'm guessing long before we met, I probably saw you then.
That was probably at the end of 75 till the middle of 77. I had taught in Parkston for four mm-hmm. years, and I wanted to play full time just because I, you know, wanted to see what it was like to be a full time musician. And I really liked it, but I did not like the restaurant food and the mm-hmm. motel rooms all the time. Yeah. So
can get a little rough.
So I lasted about 2 years doing that. Mm-hmm. And the ups and downs were fun. You know, it was.
But it had its ups and downs.
It did.
Right.
Yeah.
So then with Mogan's Heroes, you are in control as being the Mogan of the Heroes.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm in control, but we've had some pretty strong people on in our group, including Tom Stever, who played guitar and sang very well, and mm-hmm. Scott Claverkamp was basically the first drummer for about 6-7 years, and he was wonderful to work with. Then when he quit, then Doug Lund from Kello TV joined, yeah. and that was, he's just a prince of a person. He is, and he's a wonderful singer, too. And then Denny Gale joined after Tom left, and he's been with me about 23 years, I think.
Okay.
22 and a half. And then when Doug left in 2002, then Bill Hoffman joined. So that was, you know, 17 years ago, something like that.
Wow. Hard to imagine.
So really, basically only six of us covered all those.
Yeah, all the 41 years.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah, but the great thing is, if people see you around town playing a gig, and one of those former members happens to be around, they come up and they help out.
Yeah. I haven't made any enemies, I don't think. You know, people have left not because of me, but just because mm-hmm. they've got other things to do. So
yeah. So let's kind of break things up. You know, you mentioned that before doing the professional full-time part with the ups and downs, you were teaching.
I was.
You went back to teaching then.
Yeah, I've retired from teaching three times now.
Okay.
I'm a Wabe kid up in Northeast mm-hmm. South Dakota. Went to USD in Vermilion, got my Bachelor of Fine Arts in 1971, started teaching in Parkston. And that's when I quit that elementary job. But that was just a lot of fun. Parkston was, I'm glad God put me in that town, because I'd get invited to people's houses mm-hmm. all the time just to go eat dinner. You know, I was a celebrity there because I probably weighed about 295 pounds then, about 40 pounds more than I do now. And
That alone made you a recognizable figure.
Probably, yeah. I was a kind of a round figure, you know.
Well, as someone that used to be 420, trust me, I know what it's like to see people look and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And after I played with the ups and downs, and I taught in Lenox for 8 years, and I loved that, too, and got married in 1985, and I thought, oh, let's do something different. And so I sold pianos at Westmore Music for 1 year. Actually, I didn't sell very many pianos at Westmore Music, and I liked that job too, but I just financially it wasn't feasible. And so Dione Peterson, who was running the fine arts department, she and her husband in Sioux Falls, came to me and said, we need you to come and teach. So I taught at Patrick Henry for 22 years, and that was a great job. I should have taught middle school like right away. Because you have to be kind of as crazy, just like the kids.
Well, you know? And the other thing is, you hear that a lot from teachers, that you kind of have a niche in terms of whether you're an elementary, whether you're a middle school or a high school teacher.
Yeah.
And that you find the one that fits. And it was certainly evident because you and I have known each other probably going on 15 to 20 years.
Sure.
From some old radio days. And in fact, you hold a distinction no one else does.
Is that the song?
Yes, it is.
Dave and Susan, they're the
on
one Kello
we're
choosing. We're
choosing two peas in a pod. They make your head nod. I still remember it. Susan may even have a copy of it. Who knows?
I think I do, too.
Do you really?
Yeah. Brought my boys' chorus kids down
to
the studio
did.
And
yeah.
recorded it. And that
then,
was fun.
That was a great time. And then we had a little pizza party for them at your classroom, too.
Yeah.
So good. What was it the first about the teaching that you were excited about before we start moving into more of your music?
I guess my grandma Mogan was my piano teacher, and my mom was also musically active in Wabe. directed the kids' choir, or the choir at church, and I just always thought I was being groomed to be either a musician or a music teacher. And so I never really fought that, because I thought, this is fun, you know, and I can make a difference in a few people's lives, and I love kids. So was
piano the first instrument you learned?
Yeah, we all started. There are five kids in our family, and we started on our sixth birthday. My grandma, grandpa lived right across the alley from us, and so we'd have a lesson at 7 in the morning once a week. And I can remember a lot of those lessons. I came home crying because my grandma was pretty hard on us.
Oh, wow.
I didn't want to let her down.
Right.
I loved her, and she was a good old German lady. All my other grandparents are Norwegians, and I'm not trying to stereotype anybody, but, you know.
I'm guessing, though, that if grandma lives just on the other side of the alley, you probably didn't get the opportunity to skip a lesson very often.
Oh, no, we couldn't. We couldn't beg off. I did that plenty in college, though, so. Yeah.
So what other, besides the piano, what other instruments have you picked up? And
you know, I started playing baritone ukulele, which are the first four strings of a guitar. And
okay.
So played quite a bit of guitar, more folk guitar. Never been a rock and roller like the guys that play in my band. But and I was a clarinet player. I started in the fourth grade. This is kind of a funny story, because my dad was a clarinet player, and he was really good. Went to Augustana, and he sat out with one of his friends, also from Day County, who was a pretty good accordion player. That was Myron Florin. And they were friends.
No kidding.
At Augustana, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I wanted to play clarinet like my dad. Plus, there are a lot of girls in the clarinet section. So
thinking ahead.
So for Christmas on fourth grade, when I was in fourth grade, they got me a clarinet, and my dad made the mistake of showing me how to put the reed on there and put it together. And I woke up at like 5 in the morning and started marching through the house.
Goodness.
Oh, yeah. It was good. So, yeah. So with clarinet, you learn saxophone, you learn flute. And I was actually at USD, I was studying to be a band director. I thought maybe that's what I wanted to do. But Ray DeVelbus was the band director down there. And for some reason, he didn't really care for me so much.
Oh.
So I said, okay, I'll do piano and voice. So I had kind of a double half and half. So it was good. Miss Turin was my piano teacher, and she was just a sweet lady. And I called in sick way too many times.
Oh, John.
So, but I passed.
Okay, so, that's the main thing.
Yeah.
And you moved on and you started the teaching, but some other things along the way, like you mentioned. So what got you, after you'd tried the full-time part, to start Mogan's Heroes? Where did that, you had the opportunity with the little garage thing going on,
yeah,
the gig, but...
You know, when I came back from playing in the ups and downs, I joined a band from Mitchell, who I'd gotten to know when I was teaching in Parkston, called Faded Blue. Mostly high school kids, and they were really good, and they needed a keyboard player, and so I traveled with them. But it would be, you know, you drive the 85 miles to Mitchell from Lenox, and then we'd go to Agar or Gettysburg, or so I was getting home at like 0:30,
right,
and not making a whole lot of money, and I'm going, it was a good band, and I really liked the guys, but I'm going, I think I'll just put something together. So Tom Stever was basically my first guitar player, and I've never had a better friend than he is.
Excellent. So, and he was quite a radio broadcaster and still does a lot of work in the media business. So that's a great start for that. What is it that you enjoy about performing?
I like people, watching them smile.
Mm-hmm.
We've never really focused on playing what we want to play. It's more, we listen to requests. And if you play what people ask for, then they're going to keep hiring you, you know? And so if you make them happy, then that makes me happy too.
The guy that provides so many great intros and voices is Zach Dresch. In fact, he does the liners, the open and the close for this show. He's also a musician, an actor, an improv comedian, and a stand-up comedian. So I wanted to know what style of comedy he does.
A mixture of all my influences. I love one-liner comedians, comics that have great stories that are shorter. I appreciate a comic that can tell a great story and keep you laughing the entire way. A mixture of impressions, one-liners, and parodies. So that's like Weird Al is my idol. I love Weird Al parodies. That's where what I grew up with. I love one-liner comedians like Stephen Wright, mm-hmm. Dimitri Martin, Mitch Hedberg. All those guys influenced me. And I basically take everything I was influenced by and make it into a 50-minute set because I worshipped Saturday Night Live and Kids in the Hall. So impressions is what I love to do. So I like to... I took huge influence from like Phil Hartman and Daryl Hammond.
Oh, excellent.
Daryl Hammond is a really underrated cast member because he could impersonate someone to a T. And he, I read his book. I don't know if you've read his book, but it's very depressing because
really?
He had a very bad childhood.
Okay.
Abusive parents, all this stuff. But he talked about his experiences backstage at SNL and how he would go through impressions and he would watch videotapes of them and repeat them over and over again until he got the voice down. Like Al Gore, he would just watch on a loop on video and just, I distance myself and all this kind of
Tipper
stuff.
And
like, right. Yeah. The lockbox and all this kind of stuff. And so I just basically like, I impersonate a lot of the people I work with at work too. So it's kind of fun for me.
Do they know that you're doing that?
Some of them.
Okay, good.
And the ones that ask me if I have one for them, I usually lie and say I don't.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like the man that writes a paycheck.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. You got to watch out for that part. No doubt about that.
I think I've done my impression in front of him, and he goes, yeah, it's not me.
But just remember, it's the sincerest form of flattery.
Exactly.
Yeah, you tell him that, right?
Yeah.
Lead up to it with that. That's
right.
Always a good thing. So what got you started in comedy? What the fact that you'd been on stage and doing so many different things?
Improv was my start, actually. Mm-hmm. I grew up watching stand-up and SNL and all this endlessly. I was always a fan, and I'd always toyed with, like, I'd like to perform at some point, but I never knew how or where to go about doing that. And then I went to college. I had done a couple of... I was late to the boat on performing. I didn't do plays till senior year of high school. And so I did a couple of plays. I was kind of the comic relief in the plays, and that I got a big reaction. And I was like, oh, that actually feels really good. I really like this. I was playing the humorous roles that just had a couple lines, then he left the stage. That's my favorite role to play because you're not like the heartbeat of the show. You're not like the heartthrob lead that it has to choose between two women. God, that must suck. I've mentioned that on stage. I'm like, why is that? It's like... Be grateful you have two women pining for your affection. Screw yourself.
Pining is a great word,
right,
too,
pining.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Love it.
Matt, pineapple's great. I just love being that guy that just says, like, dude, screw yourself, and then walk off stage. That's kind of my... I've always been a fan of that guy. And then freshman year of college, I met Debbie Jones at USF where we went to college together, and she goes, you should really try... just come to improv Monday night. Check it out. See what you think. And I... met all these friends, made a bunch of friends. That was my group. And so we did improv every Monday night. We did shows every couple months to the faculty and students, and it was a great time. That sparked me. I started doing plays at USF, and then we went to American College Theater Festival in Lincoln, Nebraska, where it was being held that year. And there was an open mic night, and I was like, I might try stand-up. I think I'm going to try stand-up, and everyone that was with me on the trip's like, yeah, give it, write some material. So I wrote 5 minutes of material that day.
For that night.
And my first crowd was like 300 people. And I wasn't
gracious,
afraid
man.
As much because
no,
it was just, like, I've been used to performing in front of 500 people for plays, so it wasn't as scary to me. But it's your own voice, your own material. And so at first I stumbled because I was like, oh, what's my first joke? And then I grabbed my phone. I'm like, oh, okay, here we go. And then I had a good set, the rest of the five. And I was like, I'm gonna give this a try. And like a month later, I had just stuck to plays for a while because I didn't have a lot of time. I hit up Nate Holtz, who had been running all the Rookies shows when Rookies was here in town doing stand-up. And so I started going to open mics, got friends with all the comedians there, and that's basically how I got to where I am, or just kept going to every single open mic that I could. When I wasn't in plays,
right?
Because sometimes I'd have to take a break from stand-up because I had to play in school, and so I had to focus on that. But after college, especially, that's when I really started grinding and going to every single open mic I could.
What's been the best gig so far for you?
Oh, one of my, well, I could kind of break it up by early stuff, middle, okay, and later. My first favorite show I've ever done, I was doing an open mic at Rookies, and I happened to have a lot of friends in the crowd that were there, and a comic who had been on Howard Stern, Craig Gass, was in the audience, and he had seen my set, and he went up and did a bunch of impressions and stuff and said, I want you to open for me this week, and I'm performing at Wiley's, and I'm like, me? What?
Yeah.
I still have his voicemail from me. I still kept that, because that was a first, like, big moment for me. I'm like, oh, this guy has done a lot. He's friends with all these famous, right, people like Jim Brewer, all these guys. And so I opened for him at Wiley's. The crowd loved me. And that was the first big one that, mm-hmm, I had. Second, Nathan Hoffman, who is now Natalie Hoffman, is now trans, was a comic in town here for a, mm-hmm, while, and headlined at Wacko's back in the day. And he asked me to open for him, and now she. So I had just 5 minutes. I just opened with 5 minutes, and that crowd was so laughing at everything. So that was a really good set. And so I felt really good about that. So that was one of those for me. That was a huge win. And lately, yeah, last Sunday was a huge one. So that was a huge highlight for me.
Dr. Perry Langston and Dr. Corey Tooney provide the very best chiropractic care to Sioux Falls. At XL Chiropractic, the focus is to improve your overall health in spirit, body, mind, and will, relieving your pain and helping you in your wellness goals. Discover how to get results the natural way. 605-332-9235 or xlchiros.com. That's EXCELCHIROS.com. XL Chiropractic, excellent care for excellent people.
From the Dipsy Doodle Studios at the world headquarters of Big D Entertainment, a 40-square-foot home studio in the middle of America, it's Dave Holly.
Thanks again to all 19 conversations we had in the year 2019 here on the Dave Holly Hour. And there's going to be plenty more in 2020, starting next week with a young actress-singer who's going to be in the next Goodnight Theater Cabaret. Next week, I'll also share some memories of how a couple of little boys kept themselves entertained back in the 60s and 70s. Also, for me, if you have the opportunity, come to the Sky Lounge tomorrow night, Friday night, 7 o'clock. The theme for trivia this week is Harry Potter. In the meantime, I'm Dave Holly, and for me, every day is a holiday. Talk to you next week.
The Dave Holly Hour has been brought to you by Dazzle Shows Presents, The Vaudies, and Dipsy Doodle Productions, and is produced by Big D Entertainment.